a sociology professor at the University of Connecticut, wrote a book entitled When Light Pierced the Darkness. Ms. Tech, a Polish Jew, as a child, lived through the Holocaust. Some years later, she wrote this book that described the mercy that she experienced and heard that others experienced, mercy granted to them by Christians, even though they were Jews. One Polish Jew was taken from his home to a nearby woods, relatively about halfway through the war. He, along with scores of others, were forced to strip and then kneel down, and they were shot. He was only grazed, but he pretended to be dead. Then at night, when the soldiers had left, he crawled out from under that mass, and he made his way stark naked to a nearby farmhouse. The poor peasant farmer and his wife, who were Christians, not only took him in, but for the next 27 months, they hid him until it was safe for him to leave. In the midst of the unbelievable darkness of the Holocaust, there were intermittent rays of light. The book of Genesis, particularly the early chapters of Genesis, are very dark. It is a very discouraging picture of humanity. After a very promising start in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve ruined it not only for themselves, as we saw in chapter 3, but also for everyone else. Their sin resulted in a curse not only on themselves, but a curse not only on the world, but judgment on themselves and their offspring. As we saw last week from Genesis chapter 4, Adam's and Eve's son Cain did even worse than they had done. He killed his own brother, and Cain's descendants continued in that kind of downward spiritual spiral. Now, when we come to chapter 6 next week, we will see the continuing degeneration of the human race until finally God wipes them all out, that is, except Noah and his family. In chapter 5, we come to what at first glance appears to be nothing more than historical filler, a way of connecting the present to the past, a genealogy. And while that connection to the past is important, as we will see in a couple of moments, there is more here. And Moses carefully crafts the chapter so as to communicate to us what it is that is important to him. What we will see in chapter 5 is light piercing the darkness. In the midst of a sad litany of death, we will see God's grace shining through. The tedium of a dark list makes the gracious exceptions stand out even more vividly. I'd like to read the text to you next, and I want for you both to hear it and to see it, either in your own Bible or on the screen. I want you to do a couple of things as you are listening and watching. I want for you to watch for the exceptions to the otherwise sameness. Years ago, maybe they still do it, on Sesame Street, they would often have a jingle that says, "One of these things is not like the others." I want you to watch for what is not like the rest. But I also would like for you to watch for the words, the phrases that appear again and again. For they too are indications of the technique that the author is using to make his point. Lastly, I do not want you to get hung up on the numbers that you will hear and see, and I will speak to that issue a little later. In fact, anytime you study the scriptures, these are not bad things to do. Watch for those things that appear over and over again. Watch for those things that strike you as exceptions to the normal. For they're the kinds of indications of how to properly interpret what the author is attempting to communicate. Would you stand then, please, at this time as I read Genesis 5, and I'm going to conclude the reading by reading verses 28 and 29 of chapter 9, but beginning chapter 5, verse 1. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own image, in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters, although Adam lived 930 years and then he died. Excuse me just a moment while I pick up all this garbage. Just take it with you. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years, and then he died. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he became the father of Kenan. And after he became the father of Kenan, Enosh lived 815 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enosh lived 905 years, and then he died. When Kenan had lived 70 years, he became the father of Mahalalel. And after he became the father of Mahalalel, Kenan lived 840 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Kenan lived 910 years, and then he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, he became the father of Jared. And after he became the father of Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Mahalalel lived 895 years, and then he died. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And after he became the father of Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Jared lived 962 years, and then he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. And after he became the father of Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Methuselah lived 969 years and then he died. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he had a son. He named him Noah, and he said, "He will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." After Noah was born, Lamech lived 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Lamech lived 770 years, and then he died. After Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Altogether, Noah lived 950 years, and then he died. You may be seated. Just a genealogy. When you read it, what's the sameness that you see over and over again? Well, one of them is, you hear a man's name, and then you're told how old he was when his first child was born, first son. Secondly, you are told how long the man lived after his first son was born. Thirdly, you're told that he had other sons and daughters. Fourthly, you are told how old he was when he died. And fifthly, you are specifically told, then he died. Now that litany is repeated 10 times, except once. Except once. What's the exception? Enoch, verse 24. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him. No mention of death. Now, no other genealogical listing that I know of in the Bible specifically mentions the fact that the individuals died. It's assumed that if somebody lived X number of years, that they must have then died. But that's not what Moses does. Here in Genesis chapter 5, Moses specifically calls out that issue. He says, then he died. 9 times he wrote it. 1 time he did not. Moses obviously is drawing a very sharp distinction between all of the others and Enoch. That's not accidental, it is not coincidental, it is not just literary, a mistake of some kind. It is in fact very intentional. Hundreds of years later, the author of the book of Hebrews in the New Testament tells us that that interpretation is correct. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. In the midst of this list of death after death after death, there is this one man who does not die. What is Moses' point? Now, to begin to answer that, I think it's necessary for us to look at the two other anomalies in the text. Two other times that this rather monotonous list is broken up with commentary. Commentary by Moses. Verses 1 to 3 is the first time. You'll also see it at the end of the chapter. But the first one is at the beginning of the chapter. Moses wants to make the point that just as God created Adam and Eve in the likeness of God and named them, so Adam had a son of his own made in his likeness, in his image, and Adam named him. In the first 5 books of the Old Testament, Moses will include several genealogies, linking the people of Israel, the people to whom Moses was writing in his own day, linking them to their past, linking them to Jacob, their forefather, and to Abraham, their foreforefather, and to Noah before him, and even in this text back to Adam himself. He wants his readers to know that the source of their life is God. He is as much the source of their life as he was the source of Adam's life. They are created in the image and likeness of God. Back in chapter 2, Moses has spelled out what that meant for Adam and Eve. That is, what it meant to be created in the likeness and image of God. Two words that really speak to the same concept. For God did something uniquely for Adam and Eve. God gave them a capacity that he had not given to anything else that he had created. God gave them a capacity to relate to him. God gave them a capacity to relate to each other. God gave them a capacity to relate to the rest of the world in ways that nothing else God created could. And in Genesis chapter 5, verses 1 to 3, Moses is clearly pointing out that what was true for Adam and Eve is equally true for Seth. He uses the very same words to describe Adam's and Seth's relationship that he has used to describe God's and Adam's relationship. He wants his readers to understand that what Adam had, Seth had. And what Seth had, he would pass on to his children all the way down through the generations so that they too could know they equally belong to God. Through procreation, men and women, by having children, through procreation, we are made in the likeness and image of God, as certainly as Adam was. But there's something else here. I didn't note it earlier, but another phrase repeats itself over and over again. Here's the phrase. He became the father of. What Moses is doing is tracing that father-son relationship all the way back to God himself. He wants those Israelites to live with an awareness of their connection to God. God is their father, as certainly as he was Adam's father. And that is by the same means, procreation, so God is our father. Now I said that to understand the point that Moses is making in this chapter, it's not only important to see the sameness in the genealogical listing, but it's also important to see the anomalies. And I have just very quickly already mentioned two of them. The first anomaly is the fact that Enoch did not die. I'll come back to that later. Secondly, is this emphasis I've just been talking about, this emphasis on the uniqueness of humanity, including the Israelites, that God is their father, he is the source of their life, as certainly as he was for Adam and Eve. But I want you to see the third anomaly before we draw these things together. It comes at the end of the text. Anticipating the story of Noah and the flood, Moses tells us that Noah's birth was seen by his father Lamech as a cause for hope. When Noah was born, the text tells us, Lamech said, and I mention this parenthetically, it's the only one in the listing of whom we hear something said about him by his father. Lamech said, he, Noah, will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed. Now Lamech wouldn't have known, but from the next four chapters of Genesis, which Moses' readers had in their hands, from the next four chapters of Genesis, we would learn that Noah did indeed bring comfort, much beyond what Lamech ever could have thought. For Noah was the means that God would use to save the entire human race from extinction. So there at the end again, there is light piercing that darkness. Nine times the text says, then he died. But death is not the end, because at three points throughout the chapter, light pierces the darkness. First, at the very beginning, when it's demonstrated that we are all the offspring of God through Adam and Eve and then Seth and every father and mother down through the ages. Secondly, light pierces the darkness, and it's demonstrated when Moses hints at the comfort that Noah would give, not even realizing the kind of comfort that eventually would come through the Lord Jesus himself. And thirdly, and most pointedly, I think, light is demonstrated in the very terse but pregnant comment about Enoch, that he walked with God. Now that to me is the high point, Enoch, the statements about Enoch, and I want to come back to that in a moment, but before I do, I wish to deal with a couple of questions that often come to people's minds when they read a text such as this. In fact, when they read this text. Did those guys actually live that long? Did Adam, the first human being, actually appear on the earth only 6,000 years ago? Though I probably shouldn't spill the beans this early, I will have to say to you that the answers to those two questions will be singularly unsatisfying to some of you. But nonetheless, here are the answers. Let me take the second question first. Don't ask me why I did it that way, but I have. Did the first human, that is Adam, appear on the earth only 6,000 years ago, 4,000 years before Christ, contrary to what the fossil records tell us about the appearance of humans thousands of years before that? Now, the problem is seen this way. If you take the age of each man at the birth of his first son from Abraham back to Adam, and then you add those numbers up, you might conclude that Adam was created about 4,000 years before Christ, or 6,000 years ago. We know when Abraham lived. You go back 2,000 years before that to Noah, approximately. You go back 2,000 years before that, and Bishop Usher several hundred years ago, or a couple of hundred years ago, decided, he added all the names up, that Adam was created in 4004 B.C. There's a problem. That flies in the face of evidence that we have all around us, as well as even some evidence in the scriptures. And by the evidence around us, I am not talking only about the evidence that biological evolutionists present to us, claiming that humans existed millions and millions of years ago. I'm talking about other evidence that suggests that humans have been on the earth longer than 6,000 years. Now, several explanations have been offered to account for the difference, at least for the apparent difference. The most plausible of all of those explanations comes this way, that Moses in Genesis chapter 5 has chosen not to include all of the generations. There is other textual support for that. There are a number of other genealogical listings in the scriptures, and a few of them, it can be demonstrated that the author does not include every generation. But I look at my Bible and it says that so-and-so was the father. Well, the word father can just as accurately be translated forefather. The word forefather can just as accurately be translated father. It is very possible that Moses has simply selected 10 names out of a much longer list, just as he does again in Genesis chapter 11. So it's possible that he never intended to list all of the generations. Thus, the time that appears to be relatively short could in fact be much longer. But the truth is, and this is what's unsatisfying, we just don't know. We just don't know how to explain what is the apparently relatively short amount of time between Noah and Adam, and even between Abraham and Adam. Our precise mathematical minds, at least in this day and age, we want to somehow add all of the numbers up and make it all come out. Now, to suggest what I have said does not mean that the Bible is wrong. It just means that the date of the origin of the species is not what the text is about. Moses has no intention of giving you a date for when Adam was created. That's not his point at all. Now, the first question I posed earlier was this one. Did those guys actually live that long? Could anyone live to be 969 years old? Some people have suggested that the way to account for those lengthy years, or those many years, is that they counted years differently back then. They suggest maybe every month was the same as a year or stood for a year. So it's 969 months. The problem with that interpretation is the context. When you come to Genesis chapter 6 and following, you find that a year is in fact a solar cycle. And so it's very apparent that a year meant then what it means now. It just doesn't work, that interpretation. Others have suggested that the numbers are symbolic. It's a valiant try, because all of these numbers are sevens and fives or combinations thereof. The problem is there's not a hint in the text of what the numbers symbolize if they are symbolic. People have sat around and fantasized about what they are, but there's nothing to suggest from the text what is going on. So it seems that the most plausible explanation for these long-lived or long-lived patriarchs is that in fact they lived that long. Now, we hypothesize that that might be possible because the conditions on the earth were different before the flood than after. Another hypothesis of ours is that because sin had not had as long to wreak its havoc on creation and on people, that people could have lived longer, not being subject to the same kinds of diseases, or at least the intensity of them, as later and as we are today. But again, I think the short answer is the better one. We don't know. We truly do not know for certain. But I do think that when we see how precise Moses is with these ages, there are two things that he is attempting to communicate, and I think he does communicate very clearly. One, he is communicating that these are real people. These are not mythological figures, but these are very real people. And secondly, he is communicating they lived a long time ago. Exactly how long? He does not say. When was Adam created? He does not tell us. My guess is it's not even on his mind to tell us. But they are very real people who lived a long time ago. Now with that, maybe to some of you trivia, out of the way, let me come back to what I consider to be the high point of the text. It is the man Enoch himself. We've already seen that Enoch did not die. In contrast to every other man listed in Genesis 5, Enoch was taken by God without dying. But listen, as unusual as was the end of his time on earth, I truly do not believe that that is the major point that Moses is trying to make. Yes, it's true that Enoch's end on this earth was different than the others. Yes, it's true that his end was much more akin to what happened to Elijah, the only other illustration of this. Yes, it's true that it's tempting to wonder all kinds of things about what that must have been like. But I don't think that's where Moses places his emphasis. Instead, his emphasis is on Enoch's, how Enoch's life is characterized when he is alive. What stands out from the text about Enoch? It's the phrase, he walked with God. Twice, Moses mentions it. 5:24, after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him away. Now I think the writer of Hebrews gives us further insight into this man and the way he lived. Listen to it from Hebrews 11, verses 5 and 6. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleases or pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to God must believe that God exists and that God rewards those who earnestly seek him. Now to understand the point that Moses is making, I think it helps us to remember the people to whom Moses is writing when he writes Genesis and the other first five books of the Bible. These people, these Israelites to whom he's writing, are people very much like ourselves, people who were all too ready to believe that a good relationship with God was earned by dutifully obeying the commands of God. Or, conversely, like ourselves, they were all too ready to throw in the towel, tempted to conclude that since everything and everyone dies, what's the point of going on with God? Moses comes along and he illustrates with Enoch that a person finds life by walking with God. In the midst of what is darkness, in the midst of what is death, he points out this one man and he stands out as light in darkness, this one man who understood that a relationship with God is not by mere law keeping, it is by a relationship with Almighty God. That was not only true of Enoch, it was also true of Noah. Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, we read of Noah that he walked with God. Now that's the life that Moses wanted the Israelites to live. He wanted them to live life believing that God is their father, that they are connected to God as certainly and as surely as Adam was, that they live, that they express the image and likeness of God as surely as Adam and Eve did. They are to live believing that their future is secured by God's provision as certainly as the future of humanity was secured by God's provision of Noah, and they are to live walking with God. But what does it mean to walk with God? What does it look like? What does one think and feel? How does one act if he or she is walking with God? There are lots of ways of expressing it, but I'd like for you to look and listen to a very long quote. I apologize for the length of it, but I think it is so powerful, and it so powerfully conveys the concept of walking with God. Listen then and watch. Enoch walked with God because God was his friend, and Enoch liked God's company because Enoch was going in the same direction as God and had no desire for anything but what lay in God's path. We walk with God when He is in all our thoughts, not because we consciously think of Him at all times, but because He is naturally suggested to us by all we think of, as a lover's thoughts always return to his beloved. When some change in his circumstance is thought of, he has first of all to determine how the proposed change will affect his connection with God. Will his conscience be equally clear? Will he be able to live on the same friendly terms with God? When he falls into sin, he cannot rest until he's resumed his place at God's side and walks with him again. Walking with God is a persistent endeavor to hold all our life open to God's inspection and in conformity to God's will. It's a readiness to give up what we find causes any misunderstandings between us and God. It's also a feeling of loneliness if things aren't right in our fellowship with God. It's a cold and desolate feeling when we are conscious of doing something that displeases God. This walking with God necessarily shows in all of life. Just as you instinctively avoid subjects which you know will jar the feelings of your friend, just as you naturally endeavor to adjust your actions and words to the needs of your friend, so when the consciousness of God's presence begins to have some weight with you, you are found instinctively endeavoring to please Him, repressing the thoughts you know He disapproves, and endeavoring to nurture such dispositions as reflect His own character. It's easy then to understand how we may practically walk with God. It is to open to Him all our purposes and hopes, to seek His judgment on our scheme of life and our idea of happiness. It is to be on thoroughly friendly terms with God, even when you cannot hear His voice or see His footprints ahead of you. Genesis chapter 5, I think, is a very accurate description of life as it was lived in Adam's day, Moses' day, and our own. Because of sin, death reigns. But there is light in the darkness. Death is not the final word. We are connected to Almighty God. We are made in His image and likeness. He is our Father as surely as He was Adam's. There is hope in God's provision for us through Jesus Christ, as certainly as there was to the ancient people through Noah. And there is life. There is life in walking with God. It is not merely dutiful obedience, but it's a relationship with Him. It is turning one's entire life open to Him to walk with God. Are you? Pray with me, please.